Thank you. Well, thank you very much for having me along. I have also taken the opportunity of bringing a couple of my colleagues to join me. I think one or two of them may yet join us, if not for the service bit for lunch. they have been taught to get their priorities right. And it's just a pleasure. Over the years, we've had the opportunity of working with very different ones. It's really good to see Bill, for example, Bill Cochran, who we've worked together with in the Evangelical Alliance, and just great to have had fellowship sustained in many different ways over recent months and years. So I'm going to share a word briefly. Then towards the back end of the presentation, in about an hour's time or so, that was a joke, I just want to also invite you to continue on a journey with us in a campaign we've been involved with, and it's been great to have the backing of the Salvation Army with us in a campaign called Expose. So I hope to have a chance just to look into that a little bit more fully with you. What a strange text. And every time I read this, I'm mesmerized afresh by God's ability to implicate himself and the whole program of salvation so fully with the human condition. And that's precisely what we read and what we experience in the heart of the Passion. It is a very easy thing for piety to sanitize the Passion. And it's amazing how easy it is to dualize and to sanitize the Passion by making it so incredibly spiritual that we lose the sense of the Emmanuel process, which began at the cradle, continued through the ministry of Jesus those 33 years, and then culminates in this dance of death, which we celebrate during this week. But it was a real dance of death, and it was encountered in very real human conditions. And I want to try and see if I can invite us to get back there a little during our brief time of reflection together. I was talking with colleagues in the office a couple of weeks ago as I was reading this text, and the caption in my Bible over Matthew 27 said something like, "Judas hangs himself." It just suddenly hit me. This sense of pathos, this tragedy. Judas hangs himself. And he does so in the shadow of the cross. God is about to do his best work ever. Because Jesus on the cross is God at his best. Judas isn't there to see this moment, but he conspired in it. And somehow he was a part of our redemption at cost to himself. And so this tragedy, this dance of death brings human behavior, indeed, human misdemeanor as a partnership with God's program of salvation. I don't get the mystery of God, and I am glad I don't, because there are a lot of other people who are in the same boat as myself. And I don't get it because somehow the mutuality between what God is about to do and Judas's behavior in it is just an incredible part of the mystery. I was reading Brueggemann's account of the book of Genesis. If you read Brueggemann's commentary on Genesis, you will find it's not a commentary. In fact, he calls it an interpretation of Genesis. And it's a very dangerous kind of interpretation which he brings to it. He suggests that as we look at the very beginning of the contract between God and man in the garden, even at the in the context of the fall, we're not yet even sure, in Brueggemann's opinion, whether God's going to win or the man's disobedience, mankind's disobedience, will triumph. But what he says, and I quote him here, is that creator and creature have to do with each other decisively, and neither can be understood apart from the other. That's the kind of encounter I find here in this very disturbing text. Matthew has taken it upon himself to tell us that this betrayal, which cost 30 pieces of silver, was the cost of Jesus' life in Judas' mind. The other Gospels don't tell us about 30 pieces of silver. Matthew, presumably writing to a Jewish audience, is particularly concerned to get inside the inner workings of the temple tax, this 30 pieces of silver, which would have been the official temple tax. And he wants to let us inside the story sufficiently to alert us to the fact that this was a particularly Jewish thing and a particularly institutional transaction. But he's taken us into something else, the cross purposes between God's purpose and Judas's purpose. What on earth possessed Judas to betray Jesus? Was it that he thought, I am the treasurer, here is a neat fundraising scheme? We'll just do a little bit of transaction with the authorities. What will happen is Jesus will kind of stand up to the problem. Jesus will overcome the authorities. He will get out of this situation. He's done it before. He's done a kind of Houdini's trick. And when they came to kill him on a number of occasions, he kind of slipped out the back door. 30 pieces of silver. Jesus escapes. Good deal. Was it that? Was it something far more depressing and distressing? Is it possible that something got hold of Judas, which is basically called human greed, so much that it distorts his purposes in the garden? And it distorts his view of the transaction being enacted here. Certainly he regrets it later. That's what we have seen in the text. At that point for Judas, where it became so evident that whatever he had in mind didn't work, he wants to return the money. Here is the 30 pieces. Here's your temple tax back. Too late, son, says the authority. Your problem. You live with it, not our problem. Judas throws the money away and goes to hang himself. He locks himself out of Jesus's best work. What was Judas's purpose? We know God's purpose. With hindsight, we understand that even with Judas's, what's the word? Partnership is wrong, but let's use that. Even with Judas's partnership, God has a purpose. Judas's purpose is still the thing which baffles us to this day. But I wonder if Judas has something in common with a guy called Bruno Ixell. Bruno Ixell worked with J.P. Morgan and Chase. His behavior cost the bank £6.2 billion not long ago, last year in fact. He embezzled that amount of money, cost the bank something like £92 million fine last year. When I heard that, I thought to myself, what possesses a person to be so greedy? What is it about human greed and avarice and distorted behavior, even if God is able to use it? What is it about human deprivation and greed which forces a person to do that? And this comes to the issue of the bribe which the authorities paid him. Yesterday, I buried an aunt, Aunt Lou, the last of my mother's generation, which is a little bit depressing because it means that me and my sisters are now the old people in our family. And over the mealtime afterwards, one of my grandnephews, I have a few of them, was surprised that I was a preacher because I had a dog collar on. So he said to me, he said, "I didn't realize you were a pastor." I said, "Yeah, what did you think I was?" He said, "I thought you were some ordinary guy, you know, like a bus driver or something," which was a great compliment, I thought. For him, my collar signaled that I was something else. So I said, "Yeah, you know, before I was a preacher, I had a proper job, and I worked in the probation service for about 14 years, I was telling him. One of the interesting things about that for me was when I spoke to my clients, sometimes they were older people, sometimes they were younger, sometimes they were male or female, there was always something they shared in common. A man who would attack a woman age 60 or 70, do unspeakable things to her physically for £20. Or the teenager who would come along, snatch your handbag by just basically slashing the strap, grab your handbag and run. They always told me this. They said, in order to do the crime, you have to depersonalize the person. Incredible. They said, you can't actually rob somebody if they are a person. You have to make them a non-entity. You blank them. You distort their humanity. You make them a courier of the things you want. I wonder if Bruno Ixel shared something in common with Judas. I wonder if what we see in the story of the Passion is something rather more profound than just the betrayal of a person. Because what has happened here is a whole depersonalization of Jesus, I suspect. There's a thing about greed. There's a thing about avarice. There's a thing about the contract between Judas and Jesus, which I think goes beyond the mere betrayal of friend to friend. It is the distortion of all that Jesus was and is, and something about Judas's behavior which conspires to deny God's purpose in Jesus at that time, because he was presumably totally overwhelmed with what he was seeking to do rather than possibly who Jesus was. I don't know. But there is something here about Judas's behavior which tells me and tells us, if we care to look, that there is a bigger problem than the betrayal of a friend. The whole Easter Passion is easy to diminish. It's easy to make it pious, a pious thing. Judas betrays a friend. One of the things we have tried to say in Micah Challenge and through the campaign we're doing is that this transaction was probably more than a betrayal. It's a bribe. There's a reason why the scriptures is therefore so insistent on condemning bribery. I think it's exactly the same reason as my probationers would need to hear from me. Because if you bribe, whether you're a rich person bribing a poor, whether you're a policeman bribing a driver, whether you are somebody who has custodian for goods coming in to a dock, and these are medical supplies, and you bribe before you release. A bribe depersonalizes. A bribe is more than a betrayal. It's a depersonalizing of someone to get something you want. And I love what we see, even though it's painful, in this transaction in the garden. Because I tell you what it says to me. It says that what is happening here is a very, very significant thing. My Easter sermons until last year concerned itself only with that amazing work of Jesus on the cross. And I'm not selling that short. I hope this Easter we will again bow before the mystery of the cross, the work of salvation, the work of atonement, that non-transferable work of forgiveness of sins, which came because God sent Jesus to the cross on our behalf to die in our stead, that we are made right with God through the sacrifice of Christ. I'm a preacher. I'm an evangelical type. Hey, I'm a Pentecostal evangelical type. I believe in that stuff. This is what all of my ministry has been about. But I stopped last year, partially because we've been involved in this campaign on corruption. And I looked again at this text. And what we have seen in 30 pieces of silver is something of a symbolism of that bigger thing which was happening here. So Matthew 26 begins with a trumped up trial, or was it a trial? Scholars are uncertain if this was a trial or not. The circumstances around which Jesus was taken up before the Sanhedrin and false witnesses brought before him before they decide to hand him over to Pilate may or may not have been a proper trial. Whatever the procedure was wrong, whatever the procedure was faulty, whatever the procedure was downright unjust, however you look at it. And here he is, brought into a system which treated him unjustly. And here he is, betrayed by a friend, but more than that, betrayed by institutional injustice. And this is what I think it's worth seeing here, that this betrayal is really quite an institutional behavior. It means, therefore, that the encounter which Jesus had leading up to the cross wasn't just a personal encounter. Judas betrays his friend. This is an institutional encounter. Everything about the circumstances around Jesus' betrayal is about the way in which an entire institution conspired to put him on a cross. It means everybody who comes before a trumped-up court, it means my friend, rookie, Fernando, who was arrested in Sri Lanka by the Sri Lankan government 3 weeks ago for going to look after the interest of another human rights activist, is drawn into this encounter. Because what the Bible, I think, is saying to us here is that institutional evil was at the very center of this event. It wasn't just Judas and Jesus. It was all that was behind Judas, the institution itself. And if nothing else should tell us that God is summarily concerned about institutional evil, this encounter does. It reminds us that God is a God of mystery, that a part of the mystery of the cross means that God is also concerned about institutional evil. And the bribe is more than a betrayal. 30 pieces of silver should tell us that God is passionately concerned about injustice, that God is passionately concerned about issues of justice in our criminal processes, that God is concerned about the human heart and human greed, and that everything which conspires against individuals, God is concerned about. 30 pieces of silver is a reminder that Jesus was the subject of institutional behavior, even more than he was the subject of personal betrayal. 30 pieces of silver reminds us that God is concerned about a system which ignores justice in the courts, which betrays an individual, about a system which, even after the crucifixion, treats the resurrection of Jesus as an item for a lack of transparency. Do you remember that event which happened? The great big angel comes, the stone is rolled away, Jesus emerges from death. The guards go back to the authorities and they say, hey, Jesus was raised from the dead. What shall we do? The authorities say, oh, don't worry about that. Here is some money. You go for a holiday. If anybody asks, we will cover your back. I call it the Jerusalem Gate affair, a lack of transparency. The whole Easter event says this: God is, in his work of redemption, in the great mystery of the cross, totally embroiled in the worst of our behavior, in our institutional misdemeanors, and the passion of the cross, Jesus crucified, King of the Jews, buried, raised again in controversy, is the Christ of passion who saves us as individuals, but who is committed to us in the entirety of our relationships, and who is ultimately concerned with every expression of human injustice which there is. And it turns out that Jesus on a cross is the story of redemption, but perhaps Golgotha was, after all, as well, one of the most politicized places on the planet. We want to invite you this Easter to do two things. One is to reflect on the glory and the work of the cross, but equally to remember this God is utterly concerned with who we are as people redeemed in his image after his likeness, but whom he is passionately concerned to make redemption a total experience. I've run a little bit late. Let me ask you to watch one very brief video as we explain a little bit about what our campaign is about. And I'm hoping you will be able to join us. There are some leaflets outside. I hope you can join us in Expose. You've already been on that road. I hope you'll be able to follow us just a little bit by adding your signature to something we are doing together to make a difference in God's world. Thank you so much.